From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix's report today to the Security Council on the progress of inspections in Iraq was cool, professional, buttoned down, and not a big Texas welcome for U.S. troops in Baghdad. Suddenly, the road to UN consensus is very hard to see, and the world is not in Washington's pocket tonight on Point America, on a short and rocky road to war. We begin at the United Nations with Julia Preston, UN Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Julia, thank you for joining us tonight.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. Quite a day at the UN. What was the impact, Julia, of the Blix and El Baradei statements today?
Well, the United States faced considerable opposition to the concept of early war that Secretary Powell was advocating. The weapons inspectors both gave moderately favorable reports on the progress of their inspections, and there was quite a dramatic confrontation, particularly with France, advocating continued inspections.
Julia, can you describe some of the theater of today's back and forth and presentations after Blix and El Baradei?
Well, it was a highly unusual debate because speaker after speaker cast aside their prepared remarks and really engaged in a sort of, you know, shirt sleeves rolled up confrontation and clash about their views. Dominique de Villepin, who is the French foreign minister, made an impassioned appeal for the United Nations to seek disarmament through peace. And Secretary Powell responded equally forcefully. He spoke entirely spontaneously, saying, you know, please let's not let Iraq fool the world again, and appealing for immediate council decision to authorize force.
And we even heard applause in the Security Council chamber today, at least after the French foreign minister's remarks. How raw, how unusual is this kind of back and forth in that setting?
It's highly unusual. This has not been seen at the United Nations in many years. And there was another round of applause after the Russian foreign minister, Igor Ivanov, referred to the fact that today is Valentine's Day, and he said it's a day when people become engaged and live up to their greatest hopes. And there was another round of applause, and Joschka Fischer, who is the German foreign minister who was chairing the meeting, was forced to ask people to return to their decorum.
Julie Preston, what does all this passion and kind of sword tips in debate portend for consensus over a UN way forward on Iraq?
Well, I think Secretary Powell may have been coming here today with the intention of announcing to the Council that the United States was going to come forward next week with another resolution to begin the process of authorizing force. But he left just saying that he would consult in Washington and try and consider the next steps. I think that the United States encountered far more resolute opposition today than it anticipated to the notion of early war against Baghdad.
Can you imagine at this point a compromise, a consensus that could emerge out of this very polarized debate?
Well, French officials said this afternoon after the meeting that they would not support point blank any resolution that the United States brings in next week. So there does not seem to be a way to compromise out there immediately.
Even if the U.S. resolution did not specifically endorse military action?
The French, for example, did not indicate that they would veto, but they did make it absolutely clear that they do not think that military action is justified at this time. So the United States is facing a difficult decision this weekend, I think, as to whether to come back and see if they can't get some kind of minimum vote or perhaps just walk away.
Julia, what's the talk in the halls of the Security Council? Washington has been very forthright about saying this is a test of the utility, the usefulness of the UN, even its life. Is that accepted by other UN members, or is the sense that it's Washington that's going to have to come to heel here?
Well, you know, the unexpected thing that happened today was the change of tone in the weapons inspectors' reports, and many countries, I think, even some of the smaller countries that the United States thought was in its pocket, saw this as what the Angolan called a beacon of hope. Many countries just didn't feel that they could rush to war when the opportunity for improved inspections was still out there. And so, you know, I think the United States is just going to have to consider that. It seems to be a very strong opinion in the world community.
I guess a final question then, Julia Preston, is there a sense in that community, at least as represented there today, that the combined weight of opposition might actually turn the United States away from war, or that this is just tearing it and the U.S. will go off and do now what it will without U.N. imprimatur?
I think that the hope here is that the weight of world opinion can get the United States perhaps to slow down, to take slightly more considered action. And I think that's the hope that is still alive here today.
Julia Preston, terrific talking with you. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much.
Julia Preston is UN Bureau Chief for the New York Times. She joined us from New York. So it was a big day at the UN, but not a simple day. 130,000 U.S. troops are now in range of the Gulf without a UN consensus on how or whether to use them. And the strain grows at the UN, at NATO, in old and deep alliances, and in new ones. At the UN, the Russian foreign minister made a plea for unity in the world community, but that unity was not easily coalescing around Washington's agenda. As America heads toward war with Iraq, the price tag in diplomatic relations at least appears to be rising. Did Hans Blix and Mohammed El-Baradei convince you that more inspectors are needed in Iraq and more time is needed for their work? Or is it time to gird for war? And who is winning the global debate, Washington or Paris, inspections or invasion? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from London is Barry Posen, professor of political science at MIT's Security Studies Program and a fellow at the Transatlantic Center of the German Marshall War Fund of the United States in Brussels. Good evening and welcome, Barry Posen.
Hi there.
Hi, thanks so much for being with us. Also joining me tonight from Arlington, Virginia, is Anthony Cordesman, military analyst, former director of intelligence assessment for the U.S. Secretary of Defense, currently a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a Washington think tank. Good evening and welcome, Anthony Cordesman.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us, to you as well. Barry Posen, survey the situation in the Security Council for us today. You've been in Europe, in Brussels, just very recently, in this very week. You've no doubt heard the back and forth at the U.N. today. How badly broken or how far from consensus are we here?
Well, I guess I'd say we're still fairly far from consensus, but I think a lot depends on Blix and Baradei, and I think they really settled the matter. I mean, there's no doubt that in Europe there's not as much concern about Iraq as a threat as there is in the United States to start with. And I think there's a much stronger view in Europe, particularly in the three key players in the proceedings today, Russia, Germany, and France, that war is not a good idea. The war itself, I think, scares them. They think it may not go as well as some Bush people seem to think. They worry about the consequences, what comes after. And they also worry that it might do damage to the war on terrorism. I mean, one undercurrent you hear in a lot of these conversations is bad news from Afghanistan, which may be not as clear in the United States as it seems to be here. But I hear it from almost everyone I talk to that the Afghan situation is deteriorating and deteriorating fast, and people are loath to take on a new war when the old one is not really over.
But Europe must see, must know, the degree to which the machinery of war is already in gear in the U.S. corner, and they've clearly heard the rhetoric coming out of Washington. Do these European countries in opposition to war with Iraq, do they honestly believe that they can win this argument at this point?
Well, I guess it's just not clear to me how much of a win they really expect. I mean, I think it's clear that for the Germans, this is a slightly different proposition. They're not going to approve a war no matter what, right? They're simply against the idea of using war to solve this problem. the Germans have been entirely reconditioned from the first half of the 20th century, and they're the polar opposites of the reformers themselves. They really don't like the military answer.
Poets and thinkers.
I think the bigger question is really with the French, and what do the French think they can accomplish here? And I think what you heard earlier from Julia is right. I think at minimum the French are trying to slow this process down because they do think that there's some little bit of wiggle room and some little bit of possibility that that Iraq can be brought into line here. I'm not sure they're wildly optimistic about it, but I think they see some possibility, and obviously Mr. Blix does as well.
Anthony Cordesman, we could all feel the tension in that Security Council chamber today, especially as Colin Powell spoke. You could feel how dearly he wants to keep the pressure on Iraq, and the sense that even any semblance of a consensus may be slipping away from the pressure that the U.S. military threat poses. How do you think today's debate will be seen, received in the Middle East?
Well, this has always been in some ways a coalition of the unwilling. Even the countries that are providing basing, with the possible exception of Kuwait, are doing it because we're the world superpower, not because Oman or Qatar or Bahrain feel absolutely compelled that there's any immediate threat from Iraq that requires them to support the United States. It's obvious that Saudi Arabia's support is very reluctant. The UAE, which we generally ignore, actively opposes it. There's no support within Egypt or most of the Middle East. Jordan has gone along at some risk. And this is certainly going to make that situation worse. It's going to make the domestic politics worse in Turkey as well. But I think part of the problem is that we have forgotten two things. One is that Blitz went on to talk about immediate and unconditional compliance. Now, if that is really the theme, we're talking perhaps about a month in which Iraq could, in theory, comply. To do that, it would have to meet the terms that Unmovic has already outlined, as well as provide all of the data that is missing on anthrax and VX and all of the other issues. Now, because the Iraqi ambassador spoke last, most people have ignored what he said. What he said was that Iraq did not show any willingness to destroy the missiles. It wanted to have missile tests. This would mean delays of 3 to 4 months to work out the tests. And it would not provide additional data on the missing elements of biological and chemical weapons. What it wanted to do was to have technical soil tests. Now, again, at first that sounds harmless, but it really in practice means delays of another 3 to 4 months and endless technical arguments. So, in effect, Iraq's position on the issues that really matter has been one that it's quite clear there won't be immediate and unconditional compliance, and it's going to be very interesting to see what happens when people in the UN and in the media really pay attention to the full range of debate that took place today.
But is it possible that Baghdad will interpret the very obvious rift at the UN today as leeway for it to drift away from strict compliance?
Well, I think it already has. I mean, if it was truly frightened that this was an issue of regime survival, if it really believed that there was no other choice, I don't think it would have taken the kind of stand that the Iraqi ambassador took on technical issues, which seem minor at first, but then become major sticking points.
So, Barry Posen, is it possible we'll come up to this cusp of war and then have all this fall apart, or do you imagine the United States pushing this on through to attack whatever comes?
I guess you're asking me to judge the mood in America, and I haven't been in the country for several months, but my impression from the Bush administration is that they're probably going to have this war, and they're going to have it, I think, whether they get a Security Council resolution or not. I do think, however, that Tony has made a very acute observation here, and I think if you read the Blix statement very carefully, I think there's a pretty clear warning to the Iraqis in there. And the warning is that you have a very, very brief time to get right with me, and that it's all in my hands.
So Blix and perhaps El Baradei could still turn this around. Anthony Cordesman, Barry Posen, please stand by. We have to take a short break. Did the Blix and El Baradei reports convince you to give inspectors more time or the opposite? Join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the international crisis over war with Iraq, the U.S. role in that, the U.N. role in that. You're welcome to join the conversation. Is the whole inspection regime in Iraq at this point a fiction, or is it the way to go, even now? And who is winning the global crowd here, Washington or Paris or Baghdad? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from London by Barry Posen, professor of political science at MIT's Security Studies Program, and from Arlington, Virginia by Anthony Cordesman, former director of intelligence assessment for the U.S. Secretary of Defense and now a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We are also joined right now from Washington by Jonathan Tucker, a former U.N. weapons inspector who specializes in biological and chemical arms. He's currently a visiting fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, a government-sponsored think tank in Washington. Good evening and welcome, Jonathan Tucker.
Good evening, Tom.
Thank you for joining us. I hope you heard just before the break there, Anthony Cordesman outlining an interesting prospect here. He said if you look closely, listen closely to Hans Blix today, he's actually saying there's a narrow window. It's a short leash on much more compliant response from Iraq to the demands of 1441. Do you share that view? Because at the same time, he also talked today about open-ended inspections and monitoring, which has a kind of open-ended feel to it. Is it possible that Blix himself may still spring the trap on Iraq, maybe a few weeks from now, give the signal that shapes a consensus around attack if necessary?
Well, there are two separate issues. Disarmament is the focus of the current inspections. But even after Iraq has been disarmed, there is a provision called Resolution 715 for ongoing monitoring and verification of dual-use facilities to prevent Iraq from reconstituting its weapons programs in the future. And that monitoring process can continue for several years as long as the Security Council thinks it's warranted. So there are really two separate activities that the inspectors are mandated to carry out.
So as a former inspector yourself, as you listened to Blix today, did it sound like an open-ended commitment, or did you feel a keen blade, a keen edge in there somewhere that might come into play in these next few weeks to change the kind of disarray we saw of opinion in the Security Council today?
I didn't think it was an open-ended commitment. It was more of a conditional offer to Iraq to give them more time if they are more proactive, more forthcoming with information. He was quite hard on Iraq on the Al-Samud II missile, which he said was a prima facie violation.
The missile and its range.
Right, that the range of the missile exceeded that specified in Resolution 687, which is, I'm sure, something the Iraqis were not eager to hear.
But is anyone in the Security Council going to buy that? I think it's 30 kilometers over range as a casus belli here?
Well, probably not a casus belli, but he was insisting that the weapons be destroyed. And I don't know if Iraq balks at that, that could provoke a crisis with the inspectors. On the other hand, Blix pointed out a number of areas in which Iraq was providing some degree of cooperation. For example, they had accepted a number of new surveillance modalities, including a Russian Antonov aircraft, a French Mirage, a U-2 aircraft, which would assist the inspection process.
This is overflight and surveillance.
Overflight activities. He noted that three scientists had agreed to be interviewed in private, which was a change in Iraqi behavior. He noted that the Iraqis had provided a list of 83 chemists who purportedly had been involved in destruction of chemical weapons back in 91 and could corroborate that activity. So he identified a number of areas where useful inquiry could be pursued by the inspectors. But he didn't let Iraq off the hook, and he made it very clear that he expected full and unconditional cooperation
from
Iraq.
Jonathan Tucker, you can see the chessboard like all of us here. There's a timetable. There's summer coming on. There's troops gathering that are expensive, difficult to maintain. Is there time, in the kind of time frame that we presume at this point that Washington is marching on, to follow through on legitimate inspection concerns and still be in the window that Washington sees as apparently as necessary, important, for force if required?
I actually think there is some middle ground between the French position, which calls for open-ended inspections, and the American position, which calls for immediate military action. I think probably a time frame of 2 months, perhaps a bit longer, with a firm deadline and an agreement by the members of the Security Council that if Iraq is not in full compliance by the deadline, there will be authorization by a unanimous vote of the Security Council for military action. That would be a compromise that I think would meet the needs of both the French and the Americans.
Barry Posen, I hear Jonathan Tucker and Anthony Cordesman describing a very thin beam of light where consensus might still be found here, but it suggests in part that the Europeans are posing, that the French foreign minister doesn't entirely mean it when he says war must not be the way.
Well, I think, you know, you're not only going to know the answer to that question by testing them. Mm-hmm. As I said, I think people here are very chary of war, but at the same time, it was the Europeans who fought to get this issue back into the Security Council. It was the French who helped generate the 1441 resolution, which is a rather strong resolution that makes very strong demands on Iraq for cooperation. And if it can be demonstrated to the French that Iraq has truly failed to cooperate with the Security Council and is eroding whatever legitimacy working through the Security Council in the future would have with the United States, I think it's entirely possible the French will see their interests in a different way and would change. And that's not going to change the Germans, but it's not going to matter. And if the French change, I think the Russians will change.
Anthony Cordesman, if I may, can you imagine that change transpiring in the next couple of months?
When you talk about the next couple of months, I think it's possible, because there are some real litmus tests here, and they've already been applied by Hans Blix. Iraq either destroys the missile engines or it doesn't. And it's important to note here that range is a very dangerous phrase, because what we're really talking about are rocket motors that can be clustered together to produce longer range systems, larger diameter missiles where the warheads can be used to test warheads for much more modern systems, or where you can stretch the system to provide a longer range unit, just as solid fuel engines can be stacked. So we're talking about a much more significant violation than one of, say, 30 kilometers. Or the difficulty similarly is that it doesn't really matter whether they almost comply in terms of areas like chemical weapons or biological weapons with inspection. If we can't figure out what happened to the VX, if we can't figure out in any reliable way what happened to biological weapons, if we don't know what happened to the advances they might have made in dry storable biological agents. Now, I think Hans Blix said immediate and unconditional. He stuck by the terms of the UN resolution.
I believe he used those words several times. Mm-hmm.
And the Europeans, frankly, didn't. I think Secretary Powell, frankly, didn't make the case as well as he might have, because he was much more interested in immediate action than really any additional time. So I'm not sure there's a compromise here that is possible, but certainly 2 months should be enough time to see whether Iraq really can be forced into immediate and unconditional, or whether what we have is one series of offers after another that could be staggered for a matter of months, mm-hmm. whether the U.S. is really willing to wait to mid or late April that's the real question for a whole group of military reasons.
So, Barry Posen, there's the technical case, but there is a political environment for this debate as well that will be affected.
A small number of Americans have no doubt struggled.
That will be affected by that debate today. You heard the applause in the Security Council. It was for the opponents of war. You know that there are peace marches scheduled for all over Europe tomorrow. They already began in Australia, which is already in Saturday, 100,000 people out in Melbourne. Is it possible that this charged debate may change the world climate, may change world attitudes so dramatically in this interim period that the big powers won't or can't go along with a move to war?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that, I mean, even now, I mean, here in Britain, the overwhelming majority of the population is unconvinced by the American and the British government's case for war. The French population opposes war. Spain and Italy, whose leaders, you know, joined in this letter of support for the American policy, their populations don't support the war. America takes a great deal of pride in the fact that the world has turned towards democracy. Well, one thing that has democratized is foreign policy. And this is a fact of life that, while stressful for diplomats, we should take some, I think, pride in, but now you have to deal with it. And a much more sustained and consistent campaign of public information and explanation needs to be generated over the coming weeks if people are to be brought around to understand that a war may be necessary in the event that Mr. Blix and Barry don't have the success that they hope for. And there's, you know, the Americans and the British have their work cut out for them, and I think they, for some reason, were under the impression that the report today would do a lot of the work for them. And I have to say, I was under that misapprehension too until just yesterday. I began to sort of get the sense that it wasn't going to work out for them.
It did not.
Yeah, so.
So there we are. Jonathan Tucker, I know we have to let you go in a minute. You've been there as an inspector. How do you see global politics and attitudes toward prospective potential war affecting the inspections themselves? Or do they go on in isolation unaffected by that?
You know, it's really critical for the inspectors to have a United Security Council behind them, because their power really derives exclusively from the Security Council. In my experience in the past was that when the council was united, Iraq generally backed down or was more cooperative. When Saddam succeeded in dividing the council, usually with the French and the Russians against the British and the Americans, they had much more leeway for maneuver. So that's why I think it's really critical for the U.S. to push for a second resolution that will win the support of a United Council. I think when Colin Powell got 15 votes for 1441, that was a remarkable achievement. I think to do it again will be an even greater challenge, but I think it can be done.
But tonight we seem very far from that. If that's not forthcoming, are we going to see Iraq actually pulling away from the commitments that 1441 wants to hold it to?
Well, I do think it's important to keep up the pressure on Iraq, to not let them try to extend the process indefinitely. There should be clear deadlines for compliance. And I think the inspectors made that clear in their presentations. They said there were some useful avenues that could be pursued, but they also made it clear that this is not an open-ended process and that Iraq needs to be cooperative and in an immediate manner.
Jonathan Tucker, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Jonathan Tucker is a former U.N. weapons inspector specializing in biological and chemical arms. He's currently a visiting fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sue's calling from Southborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Sue. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I guess the first point that I wanted to make is that we're talking here about whether or not we have a UN consensus. Mm-hmm. My perception is that of the mood in America is that there is no U.S. consensus. And there are people who were on board who are jumping ship on the idea now. I mean, there's lawsuits being brought by members of Congress.
This is as to whether or not they need to have a congressional declaration of war now.
Exactly. And there seems to be more and more. I mean, if you want to talk about the mood of America, well, I guess you would look at late night TV, you would look at editorial comics, and you would look at editorial pages. And
but if you look at the polls, Sue, from what I've seen, if you ask it rather narrowly, there is a majority in favor of doing what George Bush might call the necessary in Iraq.
Well, I think that that opinion is changing. Just as you know, you made the point that if we wait on this, are those European countries, mm-hmm. are they going to lose support even more mm-hmm. By their own populace? And I think that issue applies to us as well. I think as we get more information, I would say unwillingly by our government, but as we are finally allowed to see the UN process and see what the rest of the world thinks and see the lack of willingness for the world to go ahead and do this, I think that a lot of people are going to start changing their minds within the U.S. as protests are starting to erupt all over the place. More and more.
We've got it, Sue. Let me put it to our guest, and thank you for your call. Anthony Cordesman, how about it? Can you imagine the political consensus in the U.S. really spinning away from the Bush administration now in what is the home stretch of these inspections, as you describe it?
Well, first, the polls have consistently shown that Americans really want to do this as part of an international, not a unilateral effort. And I'd go back, I guess, second to a point Barry raised. The public diplomacy of the Bush administration, both explaining this war to the American people and to the world, has been at best dismal. Instead of a systematic, careful campaign to really show why it was important, what the risks were, to explain a host of technical issues relating to proliferation, which only a handful of experts understand, and to popularize them, it took about half a year to issue the first U.S. statement on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. And when Secretary Powell made his statement before the U.N., it was sufficiently unsupported so that many people, both in the U.S. and outside it, really are willing to believe that somehow the United States is lying about intelligence data, something I don't believe for a moment.
Though Hans Blix indicated this morning that he couldn't vouch for at least one example that Colin Powell cited last week.
Well, of course, remember that the U.N. has absolutely no intelligence of its own. It has no way to verify any of this. And as Secretary Powell made clear later, when you start giving away extremely sensitive data that can be used for targeting or which can tell an enemy country about your intelligence methods, you're not going to give everybody everything. But certainly what needed to be a systematic campaign on this issue hasn't been conducted, and I think that the administration has been equally slow and equally clumsy to explain to the world what its objectives are in terms of an Iraq once the war is over.
Barry Posen, we've got just 30 seconds before the break. Let me put the same question to you. Can you see the initiative spinning away from the Bush administration with the kind of display we saw in the Security Council today?
Well, I haven't looked at polls in a few days, but the basic principle that Tony discussed is right, is that there's something about the American people that makes them much more comfortable doing this if they are sure that they have other nations, other institutions involved. And the fact that they've seen on television and will hear on radio about this disunity will cause some slippage. I think that's right. And therefore, the Bush administration is going to have to think hard about just how bold they want to be, how much of the onus of success they want to take on their own shoulders. And in the event of failure, they'll be stuck with all of the onus for the failure.
They must be thinking hard tonight. Barry Posen, Anthony Cordesman, please stand by. We'll be right back. We're looking at the international crisis over war with Iraq. Who is winning the global crowd here, Washington or Paris or Baghdad? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the international crisis over war with Iraq. My guests are Anthony Cordesman, former Director of Intelligence Assessment for the U.S. Secretary of Defense and now Senior Fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. And with us from London tonight, Barry Posen, Professor of Political Science at MIT's Security Studies Program. You're welcome to join the conversation as well. Can the Bush administration herd the Security Council to the outcome it wants on Iraq? Should we go to war without a clear U.N. mandate? And is this the time for the U.S. to stride boldly ahead or to think twice? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Mary's calling. Welcome, Mary. You're on the air.
Thank you. I was alarmed listening to the speeches following the inspector's report because it seemed to me as I listened to them that there was more driving this than just than even the war to in Iraq, that what was behind this was a feeling of resistance of the U.S.'s explicit assumption of the mantle of superpower that the Bush administration has done so strongly.
So you saw the uprising of the little countries here?
Well, sort of. Even more than that, it seemed to me, as I listened to Russia, as you listened to China, a worldwide resistance to the things like the security policy, like the concept that's come out in recent articles about restructuring the Mideast, the feeling that the U.S. is throwing its weight around so explicitly that that's going to cause resistance to anything. I had a feeling as I listened that every step that we took toward this engagement with Iraq, we were losing more influence in the world.
You raise an interesting point, Mary. Let me put it to my guest. Thank you for your call, Barry Posen. Do you hear a subtext here of allergy to the hyperpower? And I guess to Mary's point, if Washington crowbars this ahead, what is it costing the United States?
I think the subtext is definitely there. And I think it's part of the thing that is created this spiral of developing friction and hostility, between this soft coalition of Russia, Germany, and France and the United States. It's quite interesting. I mean, I think the Americans only got used to the idea that they were, far and away the top dog in international politics in the mid-90s. I think it took several years after the Soviet collapse for this really to go to our heads. But it's amazing how quickly it came to be second nature to people in the policy world. And this is the first time that they've run into any significant resistance from what you might call the remaining consequential powers in the world. I mean, to get this, this coalition of these three middle powers on the European continent, I think it's quite a shock. And it obviously, this coalition is weak. It formed around substantively around this one issue. But
today, it was getting the applause, and Colin Powell looked sort of lonely.
No, and I think Mary's observation of the body language of the meeting and yours as well is right. I mean, that subtext exists, and I do think that all three of these countries understand that they still have a stake in American power. They're not sort of forming a coalition to balance against us for on an open-ended basis. But I do think that this was kind of one of these ideal situations where the nature of the issue made it legitimate to ask serious questions, and the intensity and drive of American behavior seemed too forceful, particularly when you're talking about war, particularly talking about a war that's sort of a serious war. The Americans are going to conquer a country of 22 million. This is not just moving people out of Kuwait. So I think that subtext is there.
That opportunity to humble the giant.
Well, I think you're already using an emotion-laden term, and
it seemed emotion-laden today. I guess is why I use it.
I think it's the purpose is to sort of put up a little amber light for the Americans,
yeah.
Right? That says an amber go slow light that says maybe this is going to your heads, and stopping and thinking wouldn't be a bad thing.
Steve is calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you this evening?
Good. Thanks.
I have more of a comment than a question, but I guess my perspective is this.
Bring it on.
I don't recall any time in the past where Saddam Hussein or other dictators, when they decide to breach the sovereignty of another nation and go to war, coming to the UN to ask for permission. And what I find intriguing here is if we as the United States, I don't think we're required to wait for the UN to give us permission. We have a Congress, House of Representatives, and Senate, and a legislative branch, and on the judicial branch of government. And if we decide that it's something we need to do to protect ourselves and, oh, by and by, we are typically also helping the rest of the world, mm-hmm. then why not just go do what we think we have to do?
So your attitude, Steve, is the let's roll attitude. Let's get it done.
I think we need to rely on history here, and Saddam has a history of postponing things, delaying things, not cooperating. And I think that statement that the Blix made was very imperative, that, you know, as of now, he's not had full and open cooperation. And Iraq, again, the inspectors were supposed to be there mm-hmm. to witness the disarming, not to enforce the disarming.
And, Steve, do you worry at all that this could come back to bite the United States if it should plow ahead without a global consensus, a UN consensus?
I don't think we require that. I think if we're doing the right thing, and again, it's not a unanimous thing here. I think we did have a lot of support from other countries, and it just so happened that there were a few that were not behind us. So, again, you talk about democracy and majority. I believe there was still a majority of countries supporting the U.S., unless I'm mistaken.
Well, I think at this point what I'm reading in the reports out today is that a majority on the Security Council are currently lined up against going in. So it may have to be over that if the Bush administration is intent on doing it. Steve, thank you for your call. Anthony Cordesman, I want to put to you today, after the U.N. appearance, Colin Powell was on CNN. And he was talking about saying, look, it's not only the threat that we need to deal with in Iraq. It's the upside potential here, painting a picture of a free Iraqi people on the other side of a military action and liberty and prosperity rippling out through the Middle East, changing the chemistry and the facts on the ground of the entire region. Are critics of the administration overlooking that potential upside?
I don't believe they are. Frankly, I think that's a fantasy. You know, one of the oddest aspects of this is that there are many people in Israel who somehow think that this new regime is going to be pro-Israeli because some of the outside opposition people have had to at least go along on this issue before they come into power. The fact is the new Iraqi regime will still be Arab if the second Intifada is still going on. This is not going to be a pro-Israeli regime. It's going to take years, probably half a decade, to create some kind of federal republic that really shows a sign of stability, where we know that pluralism won't be just one set of votes, where you get economic reconstruction and anything approaching prosperity. And in the Middle East, in the interim, all of the countries around Iraq, Turkey, Iran, Saudi Arabia, all of the smaller Gulf states, Jordan, Syria, have other imperatives and other issues. So this, I am afraid, is perhaps to me one of the worst arguments for this war. It is something based on a sort of neoconservative fantasy world. If there's a case for it, it's a very dangerous dictator who, given weapons of mass destruction, will be using them in an area which has about 60% of the world's oil reserves. And that may be a proper case for American military intervention, mm-hmm. but all of the problems in the Middle East today outside Iraq are still going to be there after we win, and indeed, I suspect, after we have to leave Iraq, which is not going to be that many years in the future.
And Barry Posen, we've just got 30 seconds left, but let me put it to you. You say we may be seeing an amber light from Europe. Do you see in the Bush administration, do they have time to adjust? Do they have the attitudinal capacity to adjust?
I think they have time, but there is a question of attitude. I mean, Colin Powell had to wage a heroic fight inside the administration to move it to the Security Council in the first place, and that was against the wishes of a good many people in the administration who just wanted to go after Iraq.
And who may be kicking him under the table now.
Yeah, now those people's worst fears have been realized, and it's not clear that Colin Powell will be able to carry it again. That said, I think there is still time. I mean, I don't think militarily the Americans are really ready to go before another month anyway. So I think you're going to go till March 15th in any case. Going farther in time, I think, is hard weather-wise and hard on the troops. But I doubt that it's impossible.
Barry Posen, we're out of time, but it's been a great hour. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Barry Posen is professor of political science at MIT's Security Studies Program and currently a fellow of the Transatlantic Center of the German Marshall War Fund in the U.S., based in Brussels. And Anthony Cordesman, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Anthony Cordesman is senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a Washington think tank. This is On Point. Today is Valentine's Day, and no small number of Americans have no doubt struggled through composing a love letter or note to their someone special. It's not easy. How to express those feelings in words, how not to sound completely sappy. David Lowenhertz may have some answers. Lowenhertz is an archivist who recently compiled a collection of what he calls the 50 greatest love letters of all time. Among those whose correspondence of passion made the list, Benjamin Franklin, Harry Truman, and Queen Elizabeth I. Tonight, in honor of Valentine's Day, Lowenhertz reads some of his favorite love letters from history. He begins with a letter written by the first President Bush to his fiancée, Barbara Pierce, on December 12, 1943. Just before Bush headed off to serve in World War II.
I love you, precious, with all my heart, and to know that you love me means my life. How often I have thought about the immeasurable joy that will be ours someday, how lucky our children will be to have a mother like you. As the days go by, the time of our departure draws nearer. For a long time, I had anxiously looked forward to the day when we would go aboard and set to sea. It seems that obtaining that goal would be all I could desire for some time. But, Barr, you have changed all that. I cannot say that I do not want to go, for that would be a lie. We have been working for a long time with a single purpose in mind, to be so equipped that we could meet and defeat our enemy. I do want to go because it is my part, but now leaving presents itself not as an adventure, but as a job which I hope will be over before long. Even now, with a good while between us and the sea, I'm thinking of getting back. This may sound melodramatic, but if it does, it is only my inadequacy to say what I mean. Barr, you have made my life full of everything I could ever dream of. My complete happiness should be a token of my love for you.
George Herbert Walker Bush, writing to his future wife, Barbara, on December 12, 1943. There was no shortage of drama or passion in the marriage between writer F. Scott Fitzgerald and his wife Zelda during the Roaring Twenties. The somewhat overwhelming nature of that relationship was captured in this love letter from Zelda to Scott.
I look down the tracks and see you coming, and out of every haze and mist, your darling rumpled trousers are hurrying to me. Without you, dearest, dearest, I couldn't see or hear or feel or think or live. I love you so, and I'm never in all our lives going to let us be apart another night. It's like begging for mercy of a storm or killing beauty or growing old without you. I want to kiss you so, and in the back where your dear hair starts and your chest, I love you, and I can't tell you how much to think that I'll die without your knowing. Gufo, you've got to try to feel how much I do, how inanimate I am when you're gone. I can't even hate these damnable people. Nobody's got any right to live but us, and they're dirtying up our world, and I can't hate them because I want you so. Come quick to me. I could never do without you if you hated me and were covered with sores like a leper. If you ran away with another woman and starved me and beat me, I still would want you. I know. Lover, lover, darling.
A letter from Zelda Fitzgerald to her husband, the writer F. Scott Fitzgerald, written in the early 1920s. And finally, for those without a Valentine tonight, a look at the bitter side of love. Playwright George Bernard Shaw carried on a long, platonic, yet romantic relationship with an actress, Mrs. Patrick Campbell. When Campbell got engaged to another man, Shaw wrote to her the following.
Very well, go. The loss of a woman is not the end of the world. The sun shines on. It is pleasant to swim. It is good to work. My soul can stand alone. But I am deeply, deeply, deeply wounded. You have no nerve. You have no brain. You are the caricature of an 18th century male sentimentalist, a head of gabbler, titivated with odds and ends from Burne Jones's rag bag. You know nothing, God help you, except what you know all wrong. You have wounded my vanity, an inconceivable audacity, an unpardonable crime. Farewell, wretch that I loved.
David Lowenhertz reading from a letter written by playwright George Bernard Shaw to Mrs. Patrick Campbell. David Lowenhertz is an archivist living in New York City. The letters came from his collection, The 50 Greatest Love Letters of All Time. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.